Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and this week co-host Russ Chianelli is on board. And we're going to be talking about many things, cosmology, science education, and our guest is going to be Professor Bob Scherer, Professor of Physics and Cosmology from Vanderbilt University over there in Nashville, Tennessee. So, Bob, welcome to Science Studio.
Glad to be here.
Now, before we get into cosmology and then, you know, real science, and then get back to some of your interests, as were evident in a recent Wall Street Journal op-ed piece, I guess, about how to attract people, young people, into science. How did you get attracted into science when you were a young person?
Oh, I think I had a variety of influences. I read a lot of science books when I was a kid growing up. We had an encyclopedia that's not published anymore called The Book of Popular Science, published by Grolier, and I read through the entire thing when I was 7 or 8.
Wait a minute. How big was this book to be reading through
it
at 7?
It was an encyclopedia set, so I wouldn't read the whole thing at one sitting.
No.
It's a set of 10 encyclopedias, and I would sit down and just read. They were individual articles. It wasn't a normal encyclopedia where things are alphabetized. It was just listed. It was various articles in different categories of science, so they might have something about mathematics, something about biology, and I would just sit and read various illustrations, various
So you looked at the pictures?
I looked at the pictures. I did look at the pictures, too.
Good. So what could you remember one particular section that really tickled your imagination?
Well, there was one section, and this is I mentioned this in the Wall Street Journal article. There was one section on how to do kind of a magic show with chemicals. So it included soaking a rag in alcohol and then letting it catch on fire and then discovering that it didn't actually burn the rag, which didn't quite work for me when I tried it.
Was your mother upset?
They took away my alcohol lamp, so I had to do chemistry without heat at that point.
All right. Well, that's okay for a seven-year-old.
This was in your basement chemistry lab, right?
I was a little older by then. I was about 11 or so by the time I was doing the basement chemistry experiments. But there was one where you were supposed to put a whole bunch of flour next to a funnel in front of a candle and blow through a tube connected to the funnel, and then it would produce an explosion, and I never tried that one out. Probably a good thing I didn't. So that article, that sticks in my memory as a very memorable article about the magic show with science. But there were a lot of others in the encyclopedia that I was just really fascinated by. And it wasn't actually an encyclopedia. It was really a popularization of science spread out over 10 volumes.
Were your parents supportive in the end of all of this?
Well, I think it was benign neglect. They were happy to see me do it. They were happy that I was reading instead of watching TV.
In quiet.
And as long as I didn't blow up the basement, I think they were happy.
Well, that's great. So you finally graduated from your own educational process as a young boy, went to college. You chose to do physics, chemistry, biology. How did you begin your career?
I got interested. You know, I was doing a lot of this stuff, you know, chemistry stuff and electronic stuff as a kid. I was also pretty good at math, and after a while it occurred to me that although I enjoyed doing experimental science, I actually was really bad at it. So I drifted into theoretical physics instead, and I always knew that I was interested in kind of fundamental particle physics and also kind of astronomy. So I was lucky enough that by the time I got into graduate school, there was this new field where people were applying particle physics to cosmology, and that's what I kind of naturally gravitated toward, and it was lucky timing on my part, because that's when the field really started to explode.
So anyway, there you are, you're starting your career, and you land up as a professor of cosmology, right? Is that your title,
well,
in fact?
It's professor of physics, so
right.
The specialty is cosmology.
Well,
I started out at Ohio State. I taught there for about 15 years, and then I moved down to Vanderbilt about 12 years ago to become chairman of the department here. But I'm a professor of physics. That's the department title.
Okay, so let's tell the audience cosmology.
Right.
Because that gets confused with another word that's very close.
Sure.
So tell us, what is cosmology?
So cosmology is the study of the universe on the largest scales and at the earlier time. So it's treating the entire universe as a subject for experimental study and observational inquiry. So we study the clustering of galaxies on the largest scales. We study what the universe was like when it was just a few seconds old, and even think about what the ultimate fate of the universe is going to be.
And, of course, that implies that there is, as far as mankind is concerned, only one universe. You don't start with the concept that this is one universe amongst many.
No, we don't, and I'm not a fan of that idea, but certainly there are people who have considered it, and everything is worth looking at least once.
Well, let's start then now. Now we put you in a sort of a box of some description, albeit the biggest box I can imagine. Tell us what you are physically, your own research group now is focusing on, and why you're choosing that as a topic for study.
Well, my main research effort now, I would say there are two main mysteries in cosmology. That cosmology has made incredible strides over even just the time I've been involved in it. When I was just starting out, it was kind of the Wild West of physics and anything goes kind of era. You could just come up with any theoretical speculation you wanted and write a paper on it and publish it. And what has happened over the last 20 years is that the data has gotten better and better, and we've got a fairly clear idea about quite a few aspects of what the universe is like. And the two remaining mysteries, I think the deepest mysteries, are what's called dark matter, which is this form of matter that seems to be clustered in galaxies and kind of dominates the matter in the universe. And then a second thing called dark energy, which seems to be pushing the universe apart. So one way to think about it is dark matter is holding the galaxies together, but dark energy is trying to drive everything apart. And I've mostly been concentrating on dark energy and trying to understand what kind of physical processes are at work there that's causing the universe to accelerate as it expands.
Doesn't that imply to me, I mean, the universe is expanding and is picking up speed, right?
Yeah.
And a few years back, we thought it was going to come back and collapse and, you know, go through the cycle. Doesn't that imply that we're in this huge vacuum, that as the material gets further apart, it's going to get faster?
It does. We don't know well enough the exact correct theory to predict exactly what's going to happen, but the kind of baseline model that everyone comes back to over and over again, called the cosmological constant, predicts that the universe will just expand faster and faster and faster and get more and more dilute. And in the distant future, it's just going to be a very cold and dark place.
Well, that implies an infinite vacuum, doesn't it?
Well, the vacuum, we think the universe probably is infinitely large. So there is an infinitely large universe out there, and the vacuum of space would be infinitely large, too.
It's something that makes ordinary people that don't have backgrounds in physics and mathematics in particular puzzled. Right, this whole concept of dark matter, as you're calling it, and dark energy. So I was just listening this morning about this whole concept of dark matter, and if there's so much of it out there, which is causing all sorts of perturbations of observation for astronomers, then sooner or later, a piece of this dark energy has got to interact with something. And they've got this massive experiment going on in North Dakota with liquid, I think it's xenon. And do you know much about that? Could you explain to us what that is about and how
Sure.
the theorists predict something that's going to be observable?
Well, so the dark matter, we know, feels the force of gravity, and so it's clustered in galaxies. But people believe that it also feels other kinds of forces, the kinds of forces that cause it to interact with other particles, with ordinary matter. The problem is that it interacts very, very, very weakly. And the reason we know that is if it didn't interact weakly, we would have seen it already. It would have shown up in our experiments or even in our, you know, our everyday lives. So the idea is that the stuff is very abundant and it interacts very, very weakly. And the way to detect that is to build a huge vat of stuff. And it could be lots of different kinds of stuff, but one of the favored materials is liquid xenon. You bury it deep underground so you get away from all of the other interactions from cosmic rays striking materials, because the real problem here isn't getting a signal, it's getting rid of all the other signals you don't want to see. And then you bury it deep underground and you look for these very, very, very infrequent interactions between the dark matter and the vat of liquid xenon that you put down there. And that would be a smoking gun. That would be a Nobel Prize discovery. Whoever sees that is going to be remembered in the history of science for 1,000 years.
What do you expect to see? I mean, you're the
person
thinking.
Well, the idea is that it would strike very, very infrequently. One of these dark matter particles would strike a nucleus in the xenon, and there would be a recoil, and you can suck the electrons out of that and see the signal from that.
So you're going to be looking at an excited state, if I can put it that way, of the xenon Atom?
It doesn't. Now you've got me drifting into an area that I need to check my notes on, because this isn't an area I work on directly. I believe that the idea is that the nucleus recoils from the... It actually strikes a particular particle inside the nucleus. I don't believe that it excites the nucleus to emit radiation. I believe that it knocks... I think that what they're looking at is the effect of the energy deposited in the material.
By the expulsion of some other form of energy.
The dark matter striking it, yeah.
Even for an expert in the area of cosmology, this is a bit of a black box.
You know, well, it's just that I've got, I wrote a paper on this a year ago, but the details, the exact experimental details I don't keep in my head. I always keep those on a sheet of paper that I can come back and look at.
I have this question about quantum entanglement. Quantum entanglement means when two photons spin up and spin down, emanate from a point, and the farther away they get, if you flip one, the other one flips. And it doesn't matter if they're millions of miles away. And this is something that when we did a show on this before, there was an article in Science that said Einstein 0, spookiness 1. Because everybody wonders how things can go faster than the speed of light. We thought that was impossible. And now they're talking about making transistors and communications with this and even transporting materials. And we wonder what you think about this when you think about cosmology.
It's really part of standard quantum mechanics that people have thought about since the 1930s. It doesn't really let you transmit things faster than the speed of light. It'd be nice if it did, because it's not that you flip one particle and it makes the other one flip. It's that you don't really know what direction the one particle is pointing, and then you make the measurement and discover it's pointing in one direction, and instantly the particle on the other side of the universe, if you measure it, you discover it has to be pointing in the opposite direction.
Right.
But you can't transmit signals that way, unfortunately. I mean, it would be nice if you could. People have racked their brains to try to think of a way to do it, but it really doesn't let you. It doesn't let you break the speed of light limit, unfortunately.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chianelli, co-host this week, Professor Bob Scherer, Professor of Physics, Vanderbilt University, Nashville, Tennessee, and we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Bob Scherer from the Vanderbilt University, Professor of Physics, and a student of cosmology. And we were talking about quantum entanglement. And Bob, you were saying that this is something which, it's been known in theory for a long time. And right. Now there are experiments, I guess, that have proved that this actually happens, right?
Sure.
I'm ignorant.
There have been experiments. I mean, you guys are chemists, and the fingerprints of quantum mechanics are all over chemistry. But it's a very well-established physical theory. Quantum mechanics is spooky and weird and kind of disturbs a lot of people, but it's been well-established for a very, very long time. And nothing we've done, none of the experiments that have been done have contradicted any of our ideas about quantum mechanics. I mean, the main thing is, Einstein didn't like the idea that quantum mechanics was inherently random, and he wanted a deterministic theory, a theory where if you knew everything about the system, you could predict everything that was going to happen. And the main thing that we've been able to show over the years is that idea of quantum mechanics just doesn't work. You really need, quantum mechanics at its root really is inherently random and probabilistic. It's not a theory where you can predict everything about the universe.
Well, that's where Einstein sort of coined this expression that God doesn't play dice, right?
Right.
I mean, the same idea.
But it turns out he really does play dice.
You're right. Well, that's encouraging. But let's carry on with the thought, because they say it's spooky and it's sort of, most people find it difficult to unentangle themselves from such concepts, right? Mm-hmm. And then the same thing here with dark matter, dark energy. It's possible at all that we've got something fundamentally wrong in our attitude towards the universe? Mathematics, maybe. I don't know, but are we using the wrong tools, perhaps, to examine the universe?
I guess, what dark matter and dark energy both are doing is probing how gravity works. And our theory of gravity, Einstein's theory of gravity has always passed every test that we've thrown at it. People have always wondered if there was maybe something you could add to it or if there's something wrong with it. And every time it's been tested, we found that it works really, really well. But when you get up to the level of something like dark energy and dark matter, certainly you could wonder if maybe we got the theory of gravity wrong. It's just that modifying gravity and making a theory that is consistent is really, really, really hard. Einstein was a smart guy, and I think he got things right. But, for example, there was an early theory that was trying to explain dark energy, and it seemed like it would work because it would only affect things on the largest scales where gravity is very weak. But then when you plug the equations in, you discover you get the orbits of the planets in the solar system wrong. So, you know, I've never dabbled in modifying gravity because it's something, it's not for amateurs. You have to really get into it and know what you're doing.
So, let's go back to an original question that I had. What is it that you and your group now are doing, and how do you do it?
Sure. Well, I've worked on different ideas, models for dark energy. And so what we come up with are different ideas about perhaps fields that would fill the universe and drive the acceleration. And then a lot of the time I spend numerical simulations of how these fields behave, and then you can compare them with what we observe about the expansion of the universe and see if the theory works or if it's inconsistent or if it makes predictions. You know, if it's consistent with known data but makes predictions that are different from the favorite theories, that obviously is what you want, because then you can test the theory in future experiments. So that's a lot of what I've been doing. I've been doing a little bit of dark matter work, but mostly it's been dark energy.
And you have a research group? Do you have graduate students, undergraduates?
Well, I have graduate students. I've worked with undergraduates. One of my recent undergraduates published a paper. Actually, I published two papers with recent undergraduates, which is, you know, that's one of the new things in science is we get the undergraduates working in research a lot earlier than we used to.
Well, that's true. When I first came to UT El Paso, we didn't have very many grad. In fact, we had one PhD program. And so most new people who came just worked with undergraduates, master's students, postdocs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now we've got a plethora of PhD programs. And, in fact, that's having a bit of a negative impact on the ability of undergraduate students to find space in research laboratories, which mm-hmm. is a pretty nice segue into the other area that we've got you on the telephone to talk about, and that is your concept of what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong with respect to education in science and technology.
Uh-huh.
So let's start with that one, first of all. I read an article over the holiday. I think it was on the BBC website, and it was basically about the higher education bubble. You know, we've mm-hmm. got South Sea bubbles, we've got property value bubbles. Maybe some people think that we're in a higher education bubble at the moment. And so let's start there and get your thoughts and work backwards to, you know, stimulating STEM education.
I didn't read the article, but I think maybe what they're talking about is that perhaps universities are producing more PhDs than can be employed at universities, for example. And certainly that's always been true, because if you think about it, if the employment at research institutions is static, if it's we simply replace people as they die and it's not growing, then every faculty member should produce one graduate student. Otherwise, you're going to have an increasing supply. Now, in physics, and I think also in chemistry, it's not true that people who get PhDs are solely going to be employed in universities. So there are plenty of research positions outside of universities. Now, they may not be exactly in the field that you train people for, but you give them the tools and the abilities to take on new areas and to teach themselves quickly and to do research. So, you know, it used to be when I was very, you know, an undergraduate, the big employer of PhDs outside of universities was the defense industry. Then that kind of collapsed with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, then everybody went into finance, and now a large fraction of PhDs, I think, go to work for tech companies out in Silicon Valley.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's true that we don't have control. We have a very decentralized system in the United States, which I think is a good thing. But what it means is that there's no overarching control on how many PhDs get produced. I don't think necessarily that there ought to be.
Well, what are the issues is, though, that the people in universities training the PhD students, people like yourself, myself, Russell,
sure.
We basically don't have much of an experience outside the universities.
And that's
so
true.
Therefore, we're not really doing the student body a service if we simply by implication rather than statement, say, look, come along, you can be just like me, and there's something wrong with that, I think, because we just don't know enough.
I never tell my students that. I tell them that.
Well, I don't either, but they learn this.
I tell them that, you know, the job market is tight, and I can't predict whether you're going to get an academic job or a non-academic job, and, you know, I try to be honest with them when I take them on.
Well, I want to say one of the things that attracted me to your Wall Street Journal editorial was that half my career was at Exxon Research, and the other half has been here. So I'm between, you know, industry and university, and it was very clear to me that you need to have sort of the interdisciplinary understanding of both areas to make your students successful.
Well, I think one thing that helped me is I was, when I worked at Ohio State, I ran the undergraduate program, and most of those students did not want to go into PhD programs, and so I had to familiarize myself with what kind of job opportunities were out there for students who just wanted a bachelor's degree in physics and wanted to get a job right out of college. So I think that gave me a somewhat broader perspective on the entire employment situation in physics.
We're reaching the end of the show, and I wanted to go back and ask you a question again about cosmology.
Sure.
Because I was reading a quote by Isaac Newton, and what Isaac said essentially was, you know, I don't know how people look at my work, but when I look at my work, I feel like a little boy on the beach finding a new shell and a new shiny rock and ignoring the big ocean. And that was in a book by Frank Wilczek called A Beautiful Question, when he talks about how the scientists going all the way back to Plato thought. And so when you think about the big ocean, the universe, how does it affect you?
Well, I think it gives you a certain humility, right? I mean, not just in terms of how big the universe is and how small we are, but how little we probably are understanding correctly. You know, you look back at the time of Newton, and they knew some things very, very well, and some things they got completely wrong. And I have no doubt that right now some of the things we're doing will stand the test of time, and some of them people will look back and say, how did they ever believe that nonsense?
Well, of course, the point of that is it's only a very select number of people who believe it, right? There's only a select number of cognoscenti that understand, let alone, I mean, and therefore understanding, you know, you need the knowledge to delve into the area. And so most of us are in the dark. So we're relying on a very few number of people and wonders if they're all getting sort of energy from each other and pushing further and further, but from a false premise. That's one of the issues that I think a lot of people worry about.
Well, I wouldn't worry about it because it's a very vigorous. There's a lot of back and forth that goes on in science, and not all of it is obvious because it takes place behind the scenes at conferences and via private emails. And there's a self-correcting mechanism.
I agree.
You can't get too far off track. And it's not true that scientists are opposed. You know, it's not that we have these fuddy-duddy scientists who are opposed to new ideas. I think nothing is more exciting than to see a new, unorthodox idea and then see all the puzzle pieces fit together with it.
Oh, I tell my own children that one of the best things, they say, Daddy, what really, well, father now, what turns you on? And I said, I've got to say that the one word, if I could think about it, is ambiguity. If there's an ambiguity about any situation, that really piques my interest. Just to sort of finish this off, do you think that there's a correct emphasis nowadays in North America or Western Europe on STEM education? Do you think it's overemphasized? Or do you think we're doing it rightly or wrongly, completely?
Well, I think there's a lot of things I would change, but I can't tell you everything in 2 minutes.
No.
I think it's good to get kids interested in science. I think STEM lumps together a lot of different areas. It includes technology, it includes computers, it includes mathematics and science. And they're slightly different fields, and I think people lose sight of that fact. But I do think it's important to get kids interested. I think you shouldn't just throw kids into a room with computers and assume they're going to learn computer programming. I think that you need a little bit of direction there. You know, I think there's a lot of things we're doing right, and I think there are things we can fix, but I can't tell you all that in 2 minutes. Sorry.
Well, but, I mean, I'd say myself personally, I think there's too much of an emphasis. I think that the humanities are getting pretty short shrift in large ways. I think the scientists that we're training don't know enough about literature, music, and so the people in literature and music know nothing about science, that maybe we should rethink this whole business of, you know, not so much specialization until they get to the PhD, and then only a limited number of folks.
And the other idea is they need to take risks, be able to take risks and not be told what to do every moment.
Well, I agree with that, and I think things are not necessarily set up. I think we're training a whole bunch of very academically gifted students to be very, very careful and safe. That's the message they're getting. Don't mess up in high school. Don't get a B in any course. And I'm not sure that's entirely healthy.
I think you're absolutely correct on that. I think Bs, in fact, I remember a study way back. They looked at Nobel laureates from England and looked at the type of degree they got. First class, second class, upper second, lower second, third, very, very organized. And most of the Nobel laureates didn't get first class degrees.
Mm.
They found reasons to get Bs and Cs from time to time. Anyway, Bob Scherer, professor of physics, expert on cosmology, Vanderbilt University. It's been great to have you on Science Studio. Thank you very much.
Happy to be here.
Yes,
okay.
And thank you so much. We hope that one of these days you and I can do a show on basement chemistry. The winner for me was when I got a kilogram of sodium. And
I never got to do that. I always wanted it. Had no idea how to get it.
I don't remember how I got it, but I got it. And thanks to Norman Martinez, our producer.
Thank you for the listeners out there. It's been another interesting conversation with a scientist, and we'll be back next week with yet another conversation. Bye-bye.